Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about heirloom seeds on the show today, and we have a great guest for that, Jer Gettle. He is the founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Their new catalog is out. We'll talk to Jer about some new varieties. We'll maybe even take a look at growing carnivorous plants. And of course, we'll answer your gardening questions as well as we move along, and I hope you join in. What do you like about heirloom varieties? Is there a seed you'd like to find, have a question about? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jer Gettle, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Really appreciate you having me back again.
Oh, I tell you what, I look so forward to that, your catalog, every year. And I always make sure I get it, late November, early December, so that I have friends who I give those to as gifts. They're such wonderful catalogs. How do you decide, and the varieties and the photography and everything, how do you decide when a new variety will make its way onto the page?
Oh, it's always hard to pick because there's always more varieties coming our way than we can keep up with. So literally every day somebody sends us something or we hear about something. But basically what we do is we just look for something that's unusual, interesting, colorful, has an interesting story. And if it tastes delicious or smells beautiful or whatever, we just start moving it toward the catalog little by little, finding somebody to grow the seed for us, or we grow it here on our farm. And just as soon as we identify something we love, we start working on it.
So, you know, for those who aren't familiar with Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, maybe talk about what your business does.
Basically, our seed company sells heirloom seeds, which are seeds that basically have been passed down from, you know, generation to generation. By and large, that's our biggest thing. And looking for unusual and interesting seeds, we collect them, grow them, and sell them all over the U.S. and a little bit beyond. But we've been doing it since 1998, and it's just a really fun hobby that started out as a hobby and has grown into a business. And each year, more and more people get excited and involved in wanting to grow something, you know, beautiful, different, colorful. People love the, you know, the diversity of the heirloom seeds and all the colors of, you know, flowers and vegetables and herbs.
Well, and you have this catalog is just absolutely beautiful photography. And we'll talk about some of the other things relating to it, recipes and so, and stories and so forth. But you've added a live plant division in the last few years, I think. How's that going?
It's been busy. We're actually just getting ready to start ship live plants today. Well, we'll start shipping on Monday. We're going to start selling them today. So that's keeping us really busy. It's definitely definitely a lot of interest. People, we mostly sell plants that you can't easily grow from seeds. So different fruits and berries and herbs and various other things. So it's definitely a lot of fun, and definitely always fun to see things growing in the greenhouse all winter too. That's always part of the fun.
Yeah, and we should probably give your website address right off the bat so people know where they can go to, you know, find out about the live plants or find out about the seeds.
Yeah, the website address is rareseeds.com. Rareseeds.com.
All right, rareseeds.com. You recently had to discontinue selling Purple Galaxy tomato seeds. What happened there?
It was, well, we don't know exactly, but the story started out ago about 4 years ago. We met a guy online. He's a seed collector in Europe, and he had been breeding and selecting and saving seeds for years, and suddenly he had a tomato with a little streak of purple on the inside of it, and we were like, wow, that's beautiful. And he'd crossed two different tomatoes, and he thought, okay, this must be, you know, from this cross. One of them had purple skin, and then he started saving it for five generations, and it got more and more purple as the generations went on. But anyway, long story short, we tested it for GMOs. We, you know, wanted to make sure it wasn't a GMO tomato in Europe for several different things. So we sent it to the top lab in Europe, and it came back negative. So that was good. We sent it to a scientist here in the U.S. who tested its nutrient profile and said it was different than the GMO. But then on the third test, we came back with the potential of it being GMO. So that's where it got complicated. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we decided to pull the product. You know, we don't want to offer anything until we're 100% sure it's non-GMO. At this point, we think there's a good possibility that it might have some genes from a genetically engineered tomato. And so that's kind of where we decided, you know, we don't want to take the risk and start offering it. We're glad we didn't, you know, start offering it until we did, you know, plenty of testing. But at this point, we, you know, we've had tests both ways. So we think there's a chance of, you know, the genes being, part of the genes being from the genetic engineered tomato somehow, which we don't know how that happened, but we're still trying to figure it out.
Your catalog, once again, of course, spectacular. It's 532 pages. And maybe describe what folks are going to find in those pages.
It's a mixture of varieties on the big catalog. It's a mixture of varieties. Lots of photos, of course. Lots of varieties, recipes, little garden tips and short stories. But probably the biggest thing is, you know, we want to make it look like a beautiful wish book, you know, and sitting there in the middle of winter, you people can look through and see all the color and all the variety and all the diversity and let people see things they maybe never thought of or seen before. That's kind of the goal, and get people excited about getting in the garden.
I bet there's a lot of catalog people out there or even book people who would love to have their catalogs or books go out to as many people as yours does. I mean, you have what, a million a year or something like that?
A little more than that, about 1.5 I think total this year. So
oh man, that is wonderful. What makes your seeds special?
Basically, the stories and the people they've came from, all the different places, their histories, and all the colors and diversities and flavors. It's just basically kind of shows, you know, a whole map of people's vegetable gardens all in one place. So we kind of, you know, try to document a little bit of food and plants from everywhere. So it kind of, you know, it's, you're not just seeing things from one place. As the last time I, one place, the last time I counted, we had right around almost 100 different countries represented. So it's, you know, it's definitely fun to be able to experiment and try things. We have, you know, hundreds of things from the United States, of course, but then, you know, if you want to try some from Thailand or Mexico or India, we've got all those and many others covered. So you get a lot of different diverse flavors and colors and things that do really well in different climates. You know, we have things for northern climates or southern climates. All that diversity gives people the ability to find something that will do really well right in their area.
I guess the kind of the coolest setup that you have, because you have a lot of people who grow seeds for you. They're not necessarily a part of your company in one way, but they are growing seeds for it. Tell us about some of the people who grow seeds for you.
Oh, we have a whole host of different people that grow seed for us. We have about 200 different growers. The majority, the largest portion are in the United States, but then we also have growers in places like Ghana and Kenya and Japan and Italy and France and the Netherlands and, you know, Mexico and various other places. So we have a few growers here and there all over, but our growers tend to be small, you know, family farms. You know, in most cases, it's just like literally like the immediate family, but in some cases they have a few, you know, employees as well. And it's most of these people are very excited and interested in preserving their varieties. Oftentimes the varieties that they have preserved, they grow and sell to us. Other times we send the varieties that we need produced, and then they will grow the varieties for us. And then we also grow some of the seeds here on our farm in Missouri as well, as much as we can. So we work with what we can do here, and then with, you know, a whole bunch of farmers all over that you know, are very passionate about farming and gardening.
You mentioned Japan. I think your team was traveling in Japan this last year.
Actually, one of the gentlemen we were visiting, he's here today. Actually, he just got back from Japan. He's been in Japan, and I was just actually visiting with him before the phone call, and we were talking about all the different seed growers and seed plant breeders and, you know, people that work with seeds in general and, you know, exciting potential new things for the future.
Before we take a call, how does somebody become a grower for Baker Creek Seeds?
basically they just usually reach out to us by email or in person, and then we try to figure out what they have and how much land they have and whether it will work out. And if it works out, we, you know, get them a contract and they start growing seeds for us.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, are doing it on a quarter acre, and other people, you know, have 200 acres of, you know, seed production, not necessarily all for us, but, you know, for, you know, some people are professional, you know, farmers, and other people are home gardeners that might want to have a, you know, use a quarter acre in their backyard and till it up and grow a couple crops for us.
Gary in Milwaukee has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Gary.
Well, hello. See, I'm wondering if Jerry can say a few words about rhubarb. I checked the website. Maybe I missed it, but I'm not even sure if Bakery sells rhubarb, either seeds or plants. And frankly, I'm not sure if you're better off starting with a seed or a plant when it comes to rhubarb. But I'm wondering if Jerry can say a few words about rhubarb.
Sure.
And, yeah, that's one it looks like at the moment we don't have on the website. It comes and goes. Most of the seed-grown ones, they're super easy to grow from seed. Most of the seed-grown ones will be pinkish or more greenish-stemmed. There is a few, I believe, seed-grown strains that might have more reddish stems. They all taste good, but for darker stems, usually plants are more successful because they're taken from clones. And the seeds tend to not produce as dark of stemmed varieties as what you can get from plants. So if you're looking for a dark red one, plants is probably your best option. If you're looking for, you don't care about the stem color, as you're okay with pinkish or greenish stems, either way is good to go. And seeds are a lot cheaper. We don't have any at the moment, but you can get them online at various websites, and we'll have them again. We have them from time to time. But if you're looking for dark red, though, plants are probably the way to go.
All right, Gary, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Buzz sent us an email. Can you give some advice, Jer, on repotting? Oh, repotting or dividing Venus flytrap and sundew.
That's a good question. I personally have never repotted them, so I don't have an answer. I've grown them a few times, but I've never tried to repot or divide. So that's not one I know a whole lot about.
Jer Gettle, our guest today, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Questions or comments for him? Maybe you visited his place in Missouri. Comment about that. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Emily Ralph, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau's our producer, and Clara Neipert's our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jer Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Questions about Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, or maybe just about a particular heirloom, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I really enjoyed reading about the nursery that grows carnivorous plants. Pitcher plants, I think. Tell us about that, the owners and their operation.
Yeah, I've actually not met them myself personally, but I've read the story. Michelle did the great story, a great job on that. And the operation's amazing because what they do there is basically crossbreed and develop new colors of the pitcher plant. So that's what makes their work so fascinating. Even in the wild, you'll see some diversity, but when somebody's really working on it, you can really come up with some amazing, you know, lime green and pink and red stripes and streaks and speckles. So it makes picture plants, you know, a lot more interesting than just what you might find at, you know, the local hardware store, or, you know, that you order off of a typical, you know, website. They actually, you know, have developed several dozen new color combinations. So it's made it pretty fascinating. And they'll grow in much of the country. You know, that's the cool thing about them. Outside, they will, you know, grow and produce their pods in, you know, various regions of the country, anywhere you have a damp spot.
Up they'll come. Oh, man. And there was a story about seed libraries. I think it was right after the story about carnivorous plants. What are seed libraries? Where do we find them?
A lot of most major cities will have seed libraries, and a lot of small cities as well. It's basically, in most cases, in many cases anyway, it can be anywhere. It can be in a school. It can be in a church. It can be in a, you know, it could be any kind of local nonprofit. But in general, where you find them the most is actually right in the library. Like our city here, Springfield, you go into the library, they have seeds that are available for people that can basically check them out, and they ask for you to bring seeds back in return, you know, in the fall. You know, not everybody does that, but the goal is to get people to resupply the library with seeds that they grow from the seeds they've received. So it's kind of a cool concept. You're able to go and look what other local gardeners have produced and pick up a sample, and then, you know, ideally return a sample in the fall of that seed or some other seeds.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Merritt emailed us wondering, how can you store your seeds to keep them fresh, and also how long do seeds generally last?
Well, that's a good question. Storing them is cool and dry. As long as they're dry, they can be frozen. They can be kept in a cool closet or anywhere where they stay cool and dry. As far as length of lasting, that again, if they're cool and dry, they can germinate at various different times depending on the types of seed. Like that Judean palm seed that recently germinated a few years ago was 2,000 years old. So that's and there's been other seeds that have germinated over 1,000 years old. But in general, most home gardeners can have success with seeds for up to 20 years or so, depending on the type of seed. Like I've grown tomato seeds that were 20 years old, and they probably still came up at, you know, 50-60%. But, you know, other times, it's just like any living thing. Other times, things die earlier. You know, if something ends up getting too hot where they're at, or, you know, they get damp. And sometimes seeds just are weaker than others and die quicker. So it's a good question, but there's no definite answer. Anywhere from seeds can die anywhere from 1 year to 2,000 years, literally, and maybe more. But in general, for most seeds, you know, 2 to 3 to 20 years, you know, depending on the type of seed.
Dorothy emailed us as well. Do you wondering, do you carry seeds for party time cucumbers?
We don't. That's one I'm not familiar with.
I'm not. What are, as long as we're on cucumbers, what cucumbers do you really enjoy yourself and have as seeds in your catalog?
Oh, there's so many good ones, but my favorite cucumber probably year in and year out is one we have called China Jade. It's a big, long Chinese cucumber, and it's super sweet. Very few seeds. Actually, if you grow it in a greenhouse or early in the year when there's not many insects, it'll usually be seedless. But then once they get pollinated, they will produce. So the cool thing is they'll produce fruit whether they're pollinated or not. So if you pollinate them, they'll make seeds. If you don't pollinate them, you'll get fruit either way. So they're perfect for a greenhouse.
Oh, and again, the name is China Jade?
China Jade. And it looks like for party time cucumbers, burpees would be the source for those, it appears. So burpee seeds would be where she could get some of those. I don't know anything about them. It looks like a new mini cucumber.
You have so many varieties of vegetables in the catalog. One of the most colorful varieties, I think, are carrots. I'm trying to think. It's a Japanese cucumber. Mampukuji or something like that?
Oh, yeah, the Mampukuji Japanese carrot. Those we've grown, the longest we grew this last year was just over 6 feet long. So I know we haven't reached our final total, but they're definitely some monster carrots. Our best tasting carrot year in and year out for ease of growth, and it'll grow right through the summer, is the new Kuroda carrot. It's also a Japanese carrot, but it's a shorter carrot, so it does well in heavier soils. And for year in and year out, that's our go-to carrot for just a workhorse producer that doesn't mind the warm season. You know, a lot of carrots, when the middle of summer, the flavor goes way down on them. And these maintain, you know, a pretty good flavor all through summer. So that's one thing I like about the new Kuroda. And they're juicy and crispy. But there's so many good carrots. I love a good carrot. A lot of the carrots do better in the fall, but the new Kuroda will grow well, you know, in the summer.
Ah. And there are so many varieties of corn. What's the key for successfully growing corn in a, you know, a small garden?
That's the challenge, is that, you know, to grow it in a small garden, it's hardly worth it unless you have enough space to really, it's good to get a taste, but it does take up space, and pound per pound, it's kind of a light producer compared to like zucchini or other vegetables. But other than the biggest challenge a lot of people have is keeping animals out, keeping deer out, keeping raccoons out. Other than that, you water it and feed it well, and it grows like crazy. But, you know, a lot of people, neighborhoods have raccoons or deer, and they love especially sweet corn. So that's the biggest challenge.
I tell you, some of those sweet corn varieties that you have in there are, I mean, that Hopi turquoise corn.
It's a pretty one. Yeah, that's such a pretty corn.
Oh, my gosh. And I think the prettiest, at least the prettiest photo I think I've ever seen of corn plant is the glass gem.
Glass gem is such a pretty corn, and every ear is different. There's no two ears alike, so that's what makes it fun. The colors are just so brilliant and so pretty. It's that's always about our top selling corn every year, because people just love to grow it. It's when you open them, everyone's different too, so it's great to grow with your kids. It's great to grow for, you know, ornamental, but you can also, it's not a sweet corn, but you can either pop it or you can also grind it for eating, but it's not a sweet corn. A lot of people just grow it for ornamental purposes, but it's also, you know, makes a great flour corn or a popcorn.
I tell you, that is the most beautiful ear of corn I think I've ever seen in my life. They are just absolute with so many colors, and glass is kind of a good starting term for that name, because they seem to almost shine like glass.
Yeah, it's a little bit translucent, so that's what gives them kind of that glassy texture. Oh. You can kind of see into the kernel a little bit.
Oh, man, it's an amazing plant. Well, Tim in Green Bay has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Tim. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. I just wanted to thank your guest for all he does with his organization. I help out at Heritage Hill State Historical Park in Green Bay, and we really rely on his organization and other ones to help us in our period gardens, knowing what to plant, you know, so that our gardens are historically accurate. And so it's a great place for us to go to actually get those seeds that we know were being planted, you know, in the area throughout the 19th century. So I just want to put a plug for that. Thank you very much.
Tim,
thank you. You're in a beautiful area over there. Really appreciate that. So I always love going to historic gardens and seeing everything growing, you know, all part of the period. That's so neat. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim. And I just wanted to, it reminded me that you do a fair amount of work with, I don't know what you'd call it, philanthropic work, let's put it that way. I know you send free seeds to some of the poorest countries.
We try to supply seeds to various different organizations each year. So, you know, about several thousand projects every year we try to support with seeds. So it's basically everything from, you know, seeds go overseas, and then also seeds go to school garden projects and food garden projects, you know, prison gardens, all sorts of educational gardens here in the United States, too. So it's our goal to try to anybody that requests seeds, we try to get them any nonprofit organization. Educational organization and humanitarian organization. We try to get them seeds, anybody that can use them. So that's our goal, is to provide everybody that asks for seeds for their nonprofit. We try to keep up with the requests coming in.
Jerry Gettle, our guest, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Questions, comments, maybe an experience to share? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. You know, I'd love to smell the Black Magic chocolate cosmos. Does it really smell like chocolate?
It does. Yeah, it's an amazing plant. It's there's only a few plants that have that fragrance, but that one definitely has a really strong chocolate essence to it.
Oh, I've got to get my hands on some of those seeds.
But yeah, they're beautiful, and they definitely do better in a cooler summer than we have here, so they would even do better up your way.
Well, Black Magic Chocolate Cosmos are on my list for sure. I'm looking forward to trying them out. And it was surprising to see seeds from dandelions, but they're not your everyday garden variety, I might say. Why are these so special? I think they're even pink.
Yeah, dandelions used to be developed in Japan, like for colors, domesticated, I guess, in Japan, like in the 15th century, and they've all but disappeared. So the ones we have now are actually all wild varieties, all the domesticated dandelions. I don't know of any like ones that were developed for their ornamental purposes, but these two varieties we have a white Japanese one, which is beautiful. They make a big snow white bloom. And then we have a pink dandelion, which is basically 2/3 pink and 1/3 yellow. And just, you know, it's from Central Asia. Just a fantastic dandelion to get started around, you know, your garage or your shop or whatever. And every spring it'll come up with, you know, unusual looking pink dandelion flowers. People always love and are amazed to see a pink dandelion. It's just a novelty that's really fun to think about and watch, you know, bloom in your spring gardens every year.
Well, they look beautiful, and by the way, they're not going to spread like our typical dandelion.
Yeah, they're a little bit shyer spreaders. They're kind of, but I try to get them to spread a little bit, but unfortunately, the patches stayed kind of small.
And, you know, just as an aside, one of the things I love about the book, and all the stories and all the wonderful photos and so forth, recipes. You practically have a recipe book within the book, within the catalog. And the dandelions, there was a pink, there was a recipe for pink dandelion salad. And that... And I looked at that and I thought, man, yeah, if I get my hands on what a great salad to prepare, and you know, you have company over, there would be some great conversation about that.
Yeah, people are always amazed by, you know, not just pink dandelions, but things that are in different colors than they're used to, whether it's an orange watermelon, or that's what makes these seeds interesting to me is, you know, you can get things that you just don't see every day.
Linda in Wausau has a question. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, I picked up the catalog, but I couldn't see if all these seeds need a specific zone to be planted in or anything.
So on all the seeds, primarily the zone is based, well, on perennials, it's more based on zones. On annual seeds, it's more just based on temperature times. So, the majority of the seeds in the catalog would grow fine where you're at, but it's just you got to plan the season. So, like for example, like apples or roses oftentimes have zones because they're perennial and they'll freeze out. Whereas like lettuce, you pretty much just got to figure out the season to plant it in, or tomatoes. So the zone doesn't matter so much unless you're in a very very far north zone where you have a like zone 2 or 3, zone 4 that might. But you know, zone four and on, usually you're good to grow most anything in the catalog. Your exception would be some of the watermelons. Some of the melons, you want to go with the smaller varieties if you're in the north. The larger varieties can be pushing the limit for getting them to produce. So the biggest thing, the same on tomatoes, if you're in a northern zone, go with the smaller tomatoes. Other than that, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, and melons, pretty much everything else will do fine. You know, most of the squash will do fine in the farther north zones. But again, when in doubt, going with the smaller fruited versions is always a good place to start. And if the smaller melons do well, then, you know, try a larger melon.
Linda, thank you very much for calling. Let's take a call from Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Larry. So my question for your guest is, does it make sense to start planting seeds that might be from a heirloom varieties further south that might be a little hardier as, you know, the seasons and the climate is changing? I'm in Milwaukee, and I guess I was just wondering if that would make a difference because we are seeing what appears to be a longer start to the year.
Definitely seeds from hotter climates, as climates change and as even on exceptionally hot summers, you know, Wisconsin, even though you're far north, you still get warm in the summer. So varieties that are from farther south tend to take the heat better, and not necessarily, you know, just from the U.S., but also like if you get varieties from like southern Japan or in Asia, they tend to survive the heat spells better. Some of them, the only exceptions will be some of the things from way far south, like from Mexico or near the equator, will have day length sensitivity issues. So that's the only challenge. But most things, as long as they're from a moderately southern climate, like southern U.S., southern Japan, a lot of southern China, southern Asia, but when you get too close to the equator, some crops won't grow well in the north because of day length. But in general, it's a great idea, though, for areas that have hot summers to grow varieties from the southern regions, but not all the way to like if you go to southern Mexico or far south, they tend to not produce well in the north as well in general.
Thanks, Marcus, for calling. I was thinking about my old friend Pam Yonke, who is a farm reporter, has a series of great farm shows, and she was talking about a farmer who planted some corn this last, about a week ago. And she said, well, somebody had to try it, I guess. Just a touch early for planting corn here in Wisconsin, but with the kind of climate we've had recently or the weather we've had recently, I think somebody decided just to give it a heck of a try anyway. Aaron emailed us, what's the winter sowing method for starting tomatoes here in zone 5B. Aaron was planning to try this starting at the end of March or early April. Winter sowing, but starting it in end of March, early April.
We start tomato seeds inside here in Missouri right around the end of March, mid-March. Anytime you want to start them. If you want to direct seed them into the ground, though, you want to wait probably till, you know, the 1st of May to direct seed into the ground. But if you're starting them in the house or inside, you know, at a sunny windowsill or in a greenhouse, anywhere from the middle of March to the middle of April would be fine. But in general, probably right late March is what I would recommend. But you can also direct sow, especially earlier varieties, you can direct sow in the ground, you know, after the 1st of May.
Yeah, it's a bit of a trick, or it's a bit tricky sometimes with some plants. I was thinking about green peppers plants. If you plant them, you know, you put them in, or you've got the plant in the ground, and then there's a cold snap or a bit of a cold snap, the plant will survive, but then oftentimes you're not going to wind up with any peppers.
Yes, definitely. So yeah, it's on tomatoes, you know, and peppers and eggplant in general. If you push it too early, the other option is to have some backup plans. You know, worst case scenario, you lose your tomato plants. You can always direct seed. We've done that many times, and it'll put you back. We found it only puts us back 2 or 3 weeks. So say you normally get tomatoes at the end of July, you might be the middle of August by direct sowing.
Jer Gettle, our guest, give a call with your questions and comments. Jer, of course, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jared Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Questions for him? Join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. I just wanted to take a quick minute to thank everybody who donated during our winter member drive. You and your community, you know, you depend on public radio for independent journalism, for refreshing entertainment, and its support from people like Janine and Cottage Grove, who make this essential service possible. If you missed the drive, still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. And when you do, might ask for the WPR t-shirt for $12 a month. Or you could join me and ask for the WPR sweatshirt for $30 a month. I've got one of those coming. You play an important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. Thanks a lot for your partnership. Again, WPR.org. Well, we have Charlene in Northeast Iowa with a question or comment. Let's go there. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, Larry. This is thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I have been growing the Baker Creek seeds for about 10 years now. Just a mixture of some fun veggies, 2 foot long Chinese red beans, I think, that grow great. And so I wanted to thank you. I was excited when I tuned in to hear of your guest. I do have a question. You were speaking about the glass corn earlier, which made me think of, I have been growing the striped japonica, another beautiful for foliage corn. And I'm wondering, that's a flint corn. Is that something I could also pop?
Well, actually, thanks so much for all your kind words. But yeah, I don't think it actually pops real well. You might be able to get it to pop some. A lot of the corns will pop some, but I don't think it's a, you'd have to test it. Some people get it to pop and some don't. But most of the time, it's more just ground for flour. But you could try, you could give it a try. Some people have gotten it to pop, but it's not super successful popping.
But you're going to love the look.
It's a beautiful corn, and it's also great for grinding. But, you know, you may get it to pop. Some people have, but it's not. It's probably not a top choice.
There you go, Charlene. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Dave in Toma. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I have a question. I have tried several times to grow tomatoes inside pre-season, and I've tried different lights, LEDs and incandescent, and I always use new potting soil, and I use these old cake things from Walmart that have the nice plastic lid, and my tomatoes, they always get about 1.5-2 inches high. They're as big around as a pin, and then they die. What am I doing wrong?
What do you think, Jer?
Yeah, that could be multiple things. One of the main things is if it's in the house, oftentimes it doesn't get enough light. Sometimes the artificial lights work, sometimes they don't. That's a good question. Tomatoes can be finicky. You know, moving them their location, it could be an issue with not being warm enough. It depends on how warm your house is. Most people's houses are warm enough. It could be a fertilizer issue potentially. But yeah, that's a good question. There's so many different things that could potentially be. One option though is to start them very late, you know, just get them barely started and then transplant them right out, you know, start them like 3 weeks before and then transplant right when it's time instead of starting them real early. You know, even if just a little sprout will give you a week or two start. So that's one option, is to start them, you know, right when it's basically time. And put them out in the day as much as you can, you know, on warm days, keep them outside as much as you can, because the natural light usually makes them grow a lot better.
Yeah, could be a water issue too, maybe too much or possibly not enough water. I mean, watering, you know, to get those seeds going, and what do you suggest on that, Jer?
We usually just water them once a day good, and then let them dry out a bit, and then water them the next day as long as it's not too hot. But yeah, I think, you know, it could also be, you know, a fungus or, you know, something causing them to dampen off. But, you know, have them outside, you know, as much as you can. You know, start them late. A lot of times people get them started when it's cool and dark still. You know, start them late and put them outside as much as you could in the day would be helpful, and then bring them in the evening.
Dave, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Get you on pretty quickly. Michelle in Fort Atkinson emailed us. 2 years ago, they ordered the watermelon beef steaks because they heard about them on this show. And they were amazing. Great taste and huge tomatoes. The only problem they had was keeping them water. They demand a lot. And keeping them upright. As the fruit got bigger, they had to add additional stakes to keep the plants up. She would recommend them, Michelle would recommend them. They were fun and delicious to grow. So talk about watermelon beefsteak tomatoes.
They're a great tomato. Any of the big beefsteak tomatoes, though, do take a lot of support. What we usually do is we'll take like three of the T-posts. They're the green metal T-posts you can get at the farm store. They're very sturdy. And then, you know, hook a cattle panel or a horse panel. It's one of the, it's like a very sturdy piece of fencing. And you can get about a 16-foot piece for about $20-some and a couple of T-posts. And for your bigger tomatoes in particular, you just put that in the ground and then tie the tomatoes or clip them to that fence and then prune them a little. And that will support any amount of weight generally and keep them off the ground, because if they go on the ground, you'll lose most of your fruit. So that's the easiest thing we found. There's cheaper methods, but that's the easiest, most sturdy method. Anybody pretty much can do it with, you know, if they have somebody to give them a hand, you can easily put them up. Anybody can put them up if you have somebody give you a hand for a few minutes. And that keeps you off the ground and growing well. And watermelon beefsteaks are just delicious. They get their name from tasting kind of to me, they taste a bit like watermelon. They're so sweet.
I haven't grown those. That sounds wonderful. There was another one that I've tried. I've had various over the years, the Brandywine tomatoes. Tasted good for a while, then they didn't. And there's a black Brandywine tomato in your catalog that I think has an interesting history. I think their creator was Dr. Harold Martin.
Yeah, that was a really old one we get from one of our friends we got a number of years ago, Dr. William Moyes Weaver. And that one's been going for somewhere around 100 and some years. But it was a beautiful kind of, it looks quite a bit like a Brandywine, but it has the dark kind of a brownish, blackish skin and flesh. And the dark tomatoes have a super intense flavor.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the history behind the black Brandywine, I thought was really kind of fascinating too. You have a little story about it in your catalog for sure.
Yeah, it's always fun to, you know, keep the stories alive. So much of the stories and family memories, you know, disappear, unfortunately, with the old varieties. But we try to document it whenever we can and keep the family stories living.
Yeah, it's really fun. We get calls on ground cherries from time to time. Maybe describe them and their uses. I know you have some in the catalog.
Yeah, ground cherries are a Native American plant. They grow in other places as well, but oftentimes in certain areas, people can, you know, walk out in the meadows and harvest them in the wild, but often, you know, oftentimes they're harder to find and they're smaller fruited. So the domestic ground cherries, anybody can grow them in your garden, and they're kind of like a little tomato, but they're inside of a husk. And the flavor is a little bit like tomato, but it actually tastes more like apricot, pineapple, kind of combined with a berry, kind of a strawberry taste. So you had to have this tropical mixed fruit flavor. And for making preserves or jellies or even fresh eating, they're delicious. But especially for preserves or jellies, they make the most thick, intense, delicious, like apricot, pineapple, berry-flavored jelly of any fruit I know. And they're also super easy to grow. If you can grow tomatoes, these are even easier to grow.
Yeah, and you have some great recipes sprinkled through the book. Where do you get those recipes?
A lot of the recipes come from friends and like Dr. William Moyes Weaver has done many recipes for us. And this year we featured a lot of recipes from our staff here. So a lot of our staff members came up with their favorite family recipes, and we included them in the catalog.
I know there's one for that I'm going to try. blackberry jalapeno jam. It sounds really good. Have you tried it?
I did. I believe last summer I had some when the lady made it, and it was tasty. I had it on a piece of bread last summer. It was really tasty.
Oh, man, I it just sounded so, and the recipe was so good, or looked so good to me. Oh, my goodness. Actually, I've looked through, I was thinking about some of the recipes in the book. There was one for a Tuscan white bean soup that sounded wonderful. And there was another one for nasturtiums, a green goddess dressing that features nasturtiums.
Yeah, that's my favorite, nasturtium pesto or dressing. They have the most delicious, fresh, a little bit spicy, not hot, but just a hint of spice, and just such a refreshing flavor for pesto or dressing. That's one of my favorite not only flowers, but food crops. It's just amazing. And it has an unlimited supply of leaves. And then, of course, the flowers are great in as garnishes or in salads. You know, anything, anywhere you know, want a peppery taste of flour, they're perfect. But the leaves themselves make one of the best toppings, whether you can chop them onto pizza like basil or pesto or in salads, you know, multiple different ways. Any way you use them, they're delicious.
Cauliflower is another featured vegetable, of course, in the book, and it's I think in the book it says something like our favorite spring crop.
Cauliflowers are one of our really main producers for a food crop here on the farm. Right now we have a whole bunch of them in a greenhouse. And they average in size 3 to 5 pounds. We sometimes even get them bigger. But the big old white cauliflowers are the easiest thing we know to grow, other than, you know, you have to have cool weather. And other than that, you know, they produce like, as long as the weather's not too hot, you know, like below 85 degrees. Once it gets about above 85, 90 degrees, our production goes down. But when we grow them in the cooler seasons, they are number one. Besides probably cabbage, that's another competitor. But for compared to broccoli, though, cauliflower for us, you know, way out produces pound for pound.
I was interested in the Romanesco Italia. It's sort of, it's an Italian heirloom with...
beautiful, yeah, beautiful.
The heads are different. I mean, you know, these are almost, you'd say, stunning green. Yeah,
stunning green, and they're spiraling little heads, so it's just beautiful. The difference is they're delicious, they're magnificent, but the production, the size of the heads, instead of having a 5 pound head, you'll probably get more like a pound and a half head. So it's less production per square foot, but super delicious.
Yeah. Jessica in Fall River emailed us last summer, their hardiest variety of cherry tomatoes came from volunteer plants. They remained on the vine until late October, November last fall. Jessica didn't stake them, and they grew, you know, along the ground, but they didn't want to waste the fruit, so they ended up staking and harvesting and freezing.
Oftentimes just volunteers, especially cherry tomatoes. Cherry tomatoes are very aggressive.
She said the ones they started from seed or previously were sown at the... from the store tended to get blighty and didn't produce as well.
Different varieties, you know, makes a big difference on what what you grow. And sometimes when you're planting cherry tomatoes out in the garden, it'll be a cross between other varieties that you might've had as well. So that can affect it. You know, it's definitely, the small fruiting ones that come back every year on their own, oftentimes they do kind of get established, and you'll get some people have them every year. You know, you let some go to seed and they come back up on their own each year. And many gardeners just kind of, with cherry tomatoes, just keep a continuous supply that way.
And Mary just had she emailed with a sort of a general question. Should you start your seeds indoors or directly sow them outside? I guess that depends on the plant, that you're going to wind up with.
Yeah, generally most crops I think do better just direct sowing. We do start a lot of plants though as well, because we have the space and we have the greenhouses. But for direct sowing, many crops like pumpkins and cucumbers and beans and many of your larger seeds are better to direct sow. Smaller seeds start out smaller, So sometimes the little tiny plants can get lost in the jungle of weeds that come up. But besides that, either one, if you can keep the weeds under control, direct sowing is always great. But the weeds are the challenge with the small seeds. Like, you know, the tomato plants are oftentimes smaller than the weeds when they come up. So it's, you know, that's the issue. Other than that, either way works great, though. We do a lot of both. But big seeds are usually better for direct sowing, although sometimes we start those as well. But, you know, the best way to do it, actually, is to start some early and then direct sow some. And that way, if something goes wrong with either method, you don't lose them all.
Yeah, exactly. Jerry Gettle, our guest today, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. The catalog is absolutely phenomenal, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it, or just go. You can go online to his company, rareseeds.com, rareseeds.com. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Our guest today is Jer Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. They offer over 1,000 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs. So as we talk with Jer, I hope you'll join in. What varieties of heirlooms do you like to grow or maybe eat? Be part of the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We had a question from Max in Plover, sort of a more philosophical or philosophy question in a way. Wonders if you could talk more about the philosophy of people being able to save their own seeds instead of just relying on corporate ag. And Max wanted to thank you for your work.
Well, yeah, appreciate the comment. And generally, you know, up until like the last 50 or, well, probably more like 100 years, pretty much everybody saved part of their own seeds. You know, it was, you know, very common, at least, you know, up until 100 years or so ago. You know, when America started getting more industrialized and more people started working away from the farm and the garden and didn't have as many gardens, less people were saving their seed. But it's really important because it not only keeps local varieties alive and local culture alive, but it also keeps the local food security. It also adapts the varieties for the local climate. You know, if you have varieties that you've been saving locally for the last, you know, 100 years or 200 years, even in many cases, you can find varieties. You can keep those varieties alive and going and adapting to changing climates in hot summer areas and cool areas. You have varieties that actually survive and do well. And not only that, of course, you're preserving your, you know, your history and your culture.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay has something for us. Hi, Stella. Thank you for calling.
Hi. You've been talking about, there's been a lot of questioning about whether to start things inside or direct plant them, direct sow them. And my husband makes homemade newspaper pots for starting inside. We have a greenhouse for starting in the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really wonderful because when it comes time to plant them to transplant them, you don't have to disturb the roots. You just put the whole thing, the newspaper pot, into the ground, and the roots grow right through it.
Oh, well, that sounds amazing. Yeah, that's a great idea.
I love it. How does he do it? Does he just cut the paper up and then sort of wet it down to kind of mold it?
Well, he makes strips. And then depending on the size of the pot he wants, he bought a wooden, it looks like a pestle.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a little circular hollowed out bottom, and so you wrap the newspaper around the pestle and dampen, just very lightly dampen the bottom and fold over the bottom and then press it into the mold. But he also, to make bigger pots, he just takes a glass bottle, makes a little bit wider strips, wraps them around the bottle, dampens the end, and folds the ends over and presses it down with the bottle.
That,
all right.
That is pretty cool. Jer, I don't imagine you could do that yourself because you've got a lot of plants going.
No, that's definitely a good idea, though, for people that can do it is doing the newspaper pots. They'll probably dry out maybe just a little quicker, but that can be actually a good thing or a bad thing, depending on, you know, what you're doing. But the newspaper pots is something, it's easy, and, you know, you can cycle it and get it right into the garden. So it's definitely a great idea, and it's definitely a big savings.
Terry in Dallas, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. Last year, I grew beets, and they're called, I think they're called Badger Flame or Badger Red. I can't remember. I've been looking online all over, and everybody is sold out. Anybody have any ideas where I can get a hold of some of them seeds?
That's what we're trying to produce, but it's a hard one to produce so far. I think that's why the shortage of seeds. It's definitely a shy seed producer. Unfortunately, but we are working on it. We're hoping to have seeds again in the future. I know other people are as well, but it definitely is a little bit challenging compared to a lot of beets. You know, it definitely takes a good alternative is the golden beets. That's a good alternative, and I'm gonna see. Okay, it looks like Row 7 seeds actually. Row7seeds.com actually. It looks like they might have it available right now. In small quantities.
Oh, there you go. Row 7 seeds. Terry?
Row 7, number 7.
Oh, row number
row
7.
Row number 7, seeds.com. It looks like they have it available in like 100 seed packets you can get.
Oh, Terry, there you go. Thank you so much. And they are beautiful beets.
They're delicious too. Super delicious.
Yeah. Rana in Cameron, we'll go to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jer.
Hi.
My question is, when you're bringing seeds in from overseas, what process do you have to go through to get them into the United States?
Well, there's different requirements for different seeds. Most everything requires just a simple phytosanitary certificate. Other things may require an import permit, depending on the country, too. It all varies on the country. You know, countries like Canada, you might not even have to have a phytosanitary on certain things. Most things, probably yes. Mexico has its own requirements because they're our neighbors. But then when you go out of those areas, it gets even more complicated in general. So some countries you will have to get an import permit. Other countries you have to have disease testing on certain crops, not everything, but certain crops. And it varies from year to year. Suddenly, you know, you might have to have disease testing on tomatoes. And then other years, you know, other crops will have to have disease testing. And then there's certain crops, especially related to like okra and hibiscus, that whole family is extremely hard to import without treating the seeds with like a chemical process. So we don't usually offer any seeds that are imported from like okra simply because, and other hibiscus relatives simply because it's not usually from most countries possible. But it's lots of different restrictions and lots of different, different methods depending on where they're coming from.
Yeah, that makes sense. Rana, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to David in northern Wisconsin. Hi, David.
Hi, I have a question. I live in a very wooded lot, and I have very little sunshine. I get at most a half day of sunshine in some spots. And what vegetables would you recommend that I could perhaps get some success with?
And you're
mostly, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Mostly leafy vegetables. The fruity vegetables tend to be more challenging. So leafy vegetables, small radishes. You can always try things like cherry tomatoes, but it's anything that requires fruiting takes more energy and it can be difficult. But leafy vegetables, lettuces, bok choys, mustards, turnip greens, the fruity, and then some flowers as well, like nasturtiums would be great. Violas and pansies would probably get by okay. But the fruity vegetables, I would go with the smallest ones possible and, you know, just see if, put them in the sunniest spot possible. But again, it's going to be limited production if you don't have enough sun.
Yeah. And sometimes some of those early vegetables that we have, because, you know, maybe the trees aren't leafed out as much yet and so forth, you get a little more sun earlier in the season. Some of those early, of course, now radishes might be an example. Peas might be an example.
Definitely, yeah, definitely.
That you might give a shot for, David. At least give it a try. Well, you know, that's what gardeners do. They give it a try. Thank you so much. You know, we haven't mentioned onions at all in the show. And what are some of your favorite onion varieties?
My favorite is the Ishikura. It's the green scallion-type onion, Japanese green onion. It gets about the size of a leek. It gets pretty good size. And those are my favorite for eating. I just love the big, long green onions from Japan. But I also, you know, love all the onions. But for day in and day out use, those are the most reliable to have them year round almost, you know, be able to produce them, at least in a greenhouse. Outside, you know, you can they'll grow all summer and all spring and all fall. Whereas, you know, most of your other onions, they come and they produce in that certain window and you harvest them and you store them. But they're not fresh like when you can harvest the fresh green onions.
I was struck, and I don't think I mentioned this yet, but the giant moonflowers, the photo you have in the catalog is really striking. There's a young gal, maybe one of your kids.
Yeah, one of our daughters, yeah.
One of your daughters holding these two moonflowers, and then there's the moon is in the background, and these moonflowers is striking white. And larger than her head.
They're monsters. They can grow, you know, 6, 7, 8 inches across at times. So a massive, massive flowers. And the only thing is you really don't see them in the day. So you got to go out in your garden at night. But since they're bright white, they do show up, you know, well. And if the morning is cool, they'll stay out in the morning some the next day, too. If it gets warm in the morning, they go away pretty quick.
Oh, man, they are something to see. And somebody else asked about oregano. And certainly, I know you have oregano in the catalog.
We do, yeah.
Yeah. What are some recommended varieties or types?
We just have two. We just have the regular oregano vulgare, and then we have the Zatar wild oregano. So it basically has a slightly different taste, but pretty similar, you know, overall. They both can be used for the same types of stuff. But I know there is a whole host of oregano you can get from plants, all different types and stuff. But we pretty much just grow the typical culinary varieties, and they're both delicious. I mean, I love having oregano in the spring and summer. It's always amazing, but super easy to grow. Once you get it grown, it might be a little bit of a challenge to get it dug up if you want to quit having it, but you can't get rid of it. But it is aggressive, and you can put it in your little spot, and it'll come up every year in that little spot. So it's definitely something that is good for perennializing in your garden.
Kate emailed us, back to the process of saving seeds. Is it as simple as pulling seeds out of a tomato and drying them, then planting them the next year? What does she need
pretty
to
much,
know?
Yeah, pretty much. You can just dry them and save them. There are techniques, like on tomatoes, we usually grind the tomatoes up and let them sit with their pulp. And you need to have enough of it so it doesn't dry out, but enough like a cup or 2 cups of tomatoes. You grind them up, put them in a cup or a jar, let them sit for like, on average, about 2.5 days. And then you, once it gets good and moldy looking on the top, you just pour water over it and stir it up, and the seeds will sink. And then all the pulp washes away, which will make cleaner seeds. It will also help get rid of any disease that might have been on the seeds. So that's what we do. But the fermentation process makes the seeds clean. But to be honest, you can't just save seed on a paper towel and plant them, and they'll usually do just fine.
Yeah, your operation. Tell us about your operation in Missouri. There's the size of it, and you have a lot of people that work for you, right there at the place.
Yeah, we have about here at our farm. We have two places. We have about 30 acres, about 10 miles from us, and then we have the place here, and it's again probably about 50 acres, but it's not all under production. And we have about 30 greenhouses total. And then we have our seed store here, a couple of warehouses and some seed equipment and other outside buildings. And then in Seymour, we have our warehouse where we do our shipping. And that's about 100,000 square foot building in Seymour, Missouri, just down the street. And we have about total just over 100 employees average. We range just a few over 100, like 105 employees.
Little different from when you started back when you were 17 years old.
Yeah, definitely. It's grown little by little, and lots of interest, though, in, food and flowers, and people are continuously excited to, find something new, and it just gradually expands, with interest.
Teresa in Sparta has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thank you for the call. Thank you for taking my call. We have a problem last summer with hornets, yellow jackets, in our compost pile, and we're trying to get rid of them. We sprayed pesticides inside and Raids and whatever, and now I'm thinking, can we use that compost now because it's got pesticides and things in it? It may still have wasps in it.
I doubt it won't have wasps in it. They die off from one year to the next, and they typically do not go back to the same spot. Jared, comment on the...
As far as the pesticides, I don't know. I'm guessing it would probably have broken down, but I don't know. That's that would be actually probably a question for the company that produces the Raid or whatever pesticide, if they have any data. They probably have some data on how long until it breaks down. And whether it is okay for food the following year. I'm guessing it probably has, but I don't know. They may have some data on that. On the other hand, you can't have, hornets around your house either, or wasps. I mean, if you're getting stung, that's definitely not good either. I mean, either way is a safety risk, but I would probably see if they have a number on the can, because I don't know how long, I doubt it has a real long life, but I don't know. That would be a hard question.
I doubt if it does have a long life, but it's worth it to take a look at the can and actually make the call. Rebecca emailed us on your website. She says you used to have a great reference tool, a growing guide. Is it still there?
The growing guide on the website, I think we've kind of moved it under each category. So if you go under a seed, we'll have growing tips under each category now, I believe, instead of, I think we broke it up, but you may still be able to get to the master file somewhere as well. But if you go under each category, it'll have marigold growing tips. And then you can click on the growing tips there. And then once you've clicked on the growing tips there, you can click on growing guides. And that will bring up a whole bunch of growing guides. So that's probably the easiest way, is just go onto any item and click on it, and then click growing guide. And then you can, from there, you can pull up all the growing guides.
Good points. Do you still garden with your family? Do you have a little garden plot of your own, for the family?
We just have gardens all over the farm, so it's literally anywhere we can get a garden stuck here or there, we have gardens all over. So we're always, especially spring, summer, and fall, but especially spring and summer, we always are gardening here and there, growing something. And in the winter, we're always growing something in the greenhouses, of course.
And you have, and folks can visit your...
Yeah, we're open year-round here at the farm, weekdays, Monday through Friday, we're open year-round. So basically, it's like open 8 to 4 in the winter, and then the spring and summer and fall, we're open 8 to 5 here at the farm.
So people can come and just buy seeds directly?
People come and buy seeds. On any warm, sunny day, it's crowded this time of year. We had like 80 degrees, over 80 degrees a couple of days ago, and then it cooled off a little. And tomorrow, and then, it's starting to warm up again. And then, next week we'll be busy again. And whenever it turns warm, every gardener and their neighbor wants to get out and get seeds. And, whenever it's warm, everybody gets excited.
Well, Grant emailed us wondering about establishing, he's tried to establish tarragon with no luck at all. What's the best method to establish it, maybe as an indoor garden?
Yeah, tarragon, I've never really did much with the French tarragon, so that one I don't know. I've done the Russian tarragon, and it just grew like a weed. So we had it grown in a bed outside, and it grew like a weed. I didn't really care for the flavor that much. I don't use tarragon much, so we ended up eventually getting rid of it. But on the French tarragon, I don't know. I've never attempted it. But I know the Russian tarragon, we just sprinkled some seeds, and it just grew and grew and grew, though. So I don't know about what type he might have.
And I saw there's a segment in there, and I haven't thought about this before or noticed it, I guess, in the past, radishes, fall radishes, these huge radishes.
They can grow huge. Yeah, the Sakura Jima radishes from Japan, we've harvested them almost around 20 pounds this year, so they can get monstrous.
How do they taste?
They taste pretty much like a radish, you know, a winter radish, like a daikon, kind of a crispy, a little more crunchy than a spring radish. But other than that, you know, they just pretty typical radish taste.
I love that. I love that idea of a 20-pound radish. What's your favorite vegetable, by the way?
Oh, that varies. Right now, at the moment, it was probably Brussels sprouts, but, you know, it varies throughout the year. It's continuously changing. I love carrots. I love, for growing vegetables in the winter, I think my favorite thing to grow, though, is cauliflower, probably for winter vegetables. I just love growing cauliflower, but it varies. It's hard to pick.
Yeah, and it sort of depends on what's in season right now.
Whatever's ripe and when whatever just became ripe is what I'm really excited about, or whatever's blooming right then. You know, it's like it varies literally with the week.
Are there, somebody else wondered, are there any of your catalogs left? You see them in bookstores and so forth.
We have them in bookstores, and they can still get them from us, too. So, yeah, you can get them in Barnes & Noble or a lot of different stores have them stocked. But we still have them available as well, both catalogs. So.
And, yeah, and I've got both the catalogs. And the website, again, is rareseeds.com.
That's it, yes. And people can also follow us on social media. We have a lot of people about on Instagram alone. We have over like a million people a month that watch our Instagram channel. So that's people love our Instagram videos. We have some how-to. We have some fun videos. Every day, pretty much, we come out with a new video so they can see what's happening on the farm.
And what's the Instagram? How do we get?
Oh, if you just get on Instagram and search Baker Creek Seeds, you should be able to find us.
Oh,
I think it's Baker Creek Seeds is the handle, I believe. But if you just search on Instagram, Baker Creek Seeds. But we're also on TikTok and Facebook and whatnot. So
everywhere, Jer. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking
it. Thank you. Yeah, really appreciate it. And let's get planting, I guess. It's about that time.
Right. Jer Gettle, owner, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Always a pleasure to have him on the show. And he'll be back and we'll talk with him again. Monday on the show, we'll talk about elder abuse, how to spot the warning signs and how to report it. We'll also take a look at the latest in dementia treatments. In the meantime, have a great weekend, but stay with us. Lots in store on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.